You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, coming to you from the hallowed halls of the University of Glasgow, where we're hosting our first annual Teaching Excellence Summit. The 2 days have been filled with debate about university priorities around teaching and research, lecturing versus active learning, and as Anton Muscatelli, principal here at the University of Glasgow, put it in his opening remarks, how not to let the technological tail wag the pedagogical dog. I managed to snag some of the presenters at the summit this week to get their views on some of these discussions. The first was Susie Derbyshire from Queensland University of Technology. She said that universities tend to give the impression that they value research more than teaching, even though that might not be the case.
I'm Professor Susie Derbyshire. I'm Deputy Vice-Chancellor for Learning and Teaching at QUT, which is Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia.
Can we talk a little bit about this debate that we're having today at the Teaching Excellence Summit here at the University of Glasgow? Can we talk a little bit about the nature of that debate? I mean, is it even a debate that we should be having? Is it this teaching versus research?
I think to some degree it still is, and I think that's why we are still having that debate. I think it's a shame that we often talk about either or, but I am somewhat dubious about the idea that there is just this nexus. You know, when you ask people what that really means, as this morning we've seen a whole bunch of different answers and questions and discussion, and I think it's true to say that even in institutions where teaching is really valued, and I would say without doubt the institution I work at is one of those, many staff still have a perception that research is more valued, and often that perception is there despite promotion criteria that speak against it, despite teaching awards, despite a clear investment from the top down over many years in teaching quality. And I think sometimes it really does come down to the conversations that are had between academics and their line managers. And that, I think, sometimes is we don't spend enough time countering that. But I think it's still very much people's perception.
So what kind of conversations? Is it the line managers that aren't showing how important teaching is to them? Is it like a leadership thing?
I think that there is some of that, and certainly what I've seen, again, in our own institution, where executive deans have really taken the quality of teaching very seriously, really actively engaged their leadership teams, their heads of school, who then line manage many of the academics. And I think where people have seen that and have been able to engage with the data that we have, I've seen improvement. So it's clearly made a difference in where people have placed value and where they've seen value recognised by an institution. I don't mean in awards, but I mean in actually people paying attention to what they're trying to do, supporting them where perhaps they're not being successful. And I don't think that's always been the case.
One point that was brought up, students would really feel more valued if there was value put into training researchers how to teach. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, I totally agree. And I know that there are surveys that have been done with thousands of students that have asked them, which do they value more? The fact that an academic is research active in their discipline, the fact that an academic has had some professional development around their teaching, or that they have currency within a profession that they've worked in the industry, and the research in their discipline is the lowest ranked. We've invested an awful lot of time and resource over the last years at QUT, both around a graduate certificate in academic practice, which all of our commencing academics have taken for a number of years. But also, I think the other bit that we don't talk enough about in these conversations is the fact that a great deal of our teaching in most of our nations now are done by sessional, highly tenuously employed sessional staff. And if we don't invest in their professional development, they are often the real front line. Then we can do as much as we want, really, with our tenured staff, but they are another largely invisible but critically important part of our workforce.
What's been the faculty response to the training that you are offering them? Do they kind of accept it begrudgingly? Do they go in full force embracing
the whole poll, really. I like the conversations earlier about whether or not you can mandate these things. We've strongly inferred that it's mandated.
Okay.
And actually strongly inferring it has worked pretty well in sort of 99% of cases. So we've now moved where we provide a bursary for the graduate certificate, i.e. people don't have to pay, but in a way I think it's also important still for them to understand it has value, that if they were to enrol in this course it would cost them thousands of dollars. And I think sort of we've made it competitive, people put expressions of interest in now for the course, and we've had over 250 staff complete that course. The other change we've made is recognising, and again, it's another thing that we tend to be focusing on a lot this morning, is the idea that the only people involved in teaching are academics. And increasingly, and Bev Oliver spoke well about this, it takes teams with different skills, learning designers, people who support student learning, careers. So we've opened those courses up now to a much broader mix of staff, and that's created incredible additional value as people start to understand and appreciate the different roles other people play in student success. So I think actually it's a danger just to focus on academic contribution to teaching and not focus on the other things. And again, Lauren spoke well about that in terms of it's dangerous just to focus on teaching and not the broader student experience, and what supports students to succeed is not just good teachers.
Is there, because higher education is very much existing on a global stage now, and we were talking earlier about how there's traditional cultures within different higher education systems around the world about the researcher as the teacher, and in the United States it seems to be that it's kind of an obligation that they resent having to do it, but that tradition doesn't necessarily exist in Europe and it might not exist in Australia. Is there a danger that there'll be this homogenization of that in global higher education?
Well, there's a danger of that if we all become Americanized. But, I mean, you only have to look at the growth in countries like China, emerging higher education sectors, and, you know, the rankings show how powerfully they're coming up in those rankings. We've had some really lovely engagements recently through our work with Advanced HE, actually, working with about 120 academics from 49 Chinese universities through the shared lens of the standards framework that exists originally in the HE Academy and now in Advanced HE. And the thing that the academics spoke about most when they came back was just how similar our contexts are, how much we're, you know, Chinese academics are as concerned about how they stop their students spending time on their phones in classes. They are as invested in high quality teaching and engaging students. So I think there's a danger of us assuming huge differences amongst at the root of learning and teaching that perhaps divide us more than they could. I'm not speaking for homogenisation, but I think ways to connect through shared frameworks are really powerful now, rather than ways to divide or artificially divide us. Our students move all over the world, and increasingly our academics do.
QUT has been a major supporter of technology and technology-driven education. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on the use of technology in the classroom, and if you think it's going in the right way. Obviously, it's an inevitable evolution of higher education learning, but is our flipped classrooms the right answer? Are learning analytics systems, are we going in the right direction?
Look, the way we've invested a lot in our I'm sitting here surrounded by this ancient university at Glasgow. Our campuses are obviously much more contemporary than this. But I think my argument there is it takes a certain amount of privilege to be able to attend a university on campus. You know, even in Brisbane, you need to be able to live close enough, afford to live close enough, or to travel back and forth. And again, Bev Oliver spoke this morning about how long that can take, what that can cost, and what it means that you have to give up to do that. So I think, again, what we're talking about at QT is how we can do the very best and really be thoughtful about what students could do on campus and how we do the very best in terms of what students do online. Because we know at QUT many of our students are mature, they have caring responsibilities. Almost all of our students work a considerable number of hours a week, and many of them are first in family. So if providing really powerful and engaging online learning experiences means that students can access our educational offerings in ways that they couldn't currently, I'm all for it. I really am. And I think there is so much that we do, and we've heard this morning, these tacit sort of unchallenged questions around how many pages students would be reading in a week, how many pages they would be writing. These are really old traditional views. And I think actually sometimes just examining what we do and questioning it as part of this transformation really does shed some new light on the assumptions that we've made, or the patterns of delivery that we've just become comfortable with.
Yeah.
We can see they're not working. I think we've really seen with our academics a major tipping point in the last few years where they are almost alone in a lecture theatre. And that is not rewarding for them either.
Mm. It sounds like what you're saying as well is that institutions need to just be a bit more nimble, be able to react more quickly to the challenges that they're facing, which is, I mean, to say that to a university.
But, you know, the thing that's occurred to me probably a bit lately, really, is that our universities are full of experts. It is, of course, what draws them to the profession and what allows them to remain in the profession. They are expert. And that sits quite uncomfortably with the risk of failure, particularly in front of students. So we've done a lot now at QUT to recognise innovation and to recognise the risk of failure that comes with innovation. And in fact, this semester, for the first time, we are flagging units, called courses in other programmes, where academics are making an attempt to make significant evidence-based innovation. And that's partly because then they don't get, if their unit flags as red, their line manager can see that that is in the context of really considered innovation. And I think we have to understand that tension between being expert in a discipline and the risk associated with major change in pedagogy, and that cannot be underestimated.
We're talking about, this is the inaugural Teaching Excellence Summit for THE. You're from England, so I'm sure you're very much aware of the TEF. Why are we talking about teaching? Why is this a conversation that we're having now?
Look, I think it's really welcome. I think there are various reasons. Some of them are to do with a consumer mentality, i.e. far more students around the world now are being required to pay fees. And I think they also, we live in a culture where people want information. I mean, you know, I've booked almost everywhere I'm staying on this trip with the use of booking.com, and I read reviews and I am influenced by reviews. The combination of review and value for money. And that's the culture we live in. I also think that it's good in a way that we are questioning this sort of innate assumption that universities that are old are necessarily best at teaching, that universities that are excellent at research are just necessarily good at teaching too. So I welcome the call to measure it. I think what we've discussed already this morning is that perhaps the measures we have available to us are limiting. But I mean, the measures we have that measure research are just widely accepted. I'm not sure they're perfect, they're just widely accepted. And the ones that we have for teaching are, people seek to discredit them, even the ones we have.
Is it even measurable, teaching? Will we ever get to that?
I'm much less interested in measuring teaching. I think what we need to focus on a lot more is learning, and learning gains. And I think that's where the online really will help us, actually. And again, Bev Oliver spoke about that this morning. Some of the issues about measuring teaching, if it is that it's an input, and the better the students are that, you know, you start with. If you have students that come from excellent schools who have highly effective ways of learning themselves, really it's almost do no harm. If you do have a mission that is about first in family and low socioeconomic and students from different races, then really you need to work harder and really be thoughtful about what's going to engage those students and help them to succeed. So the, hopefully the learning gain is going to be more. And I think perhaps we've not placed enough effort around trying to measure learning gain. And that's, you know, we've talked about some of those ideas this morning. So less of an input and more of an output or an outcome.
And that was Susie Derbyshire from Queensland University of Technology. Next, I spoke with...
I'm Bob Duke. I'm a professor of music and human learning at the University of Texas at Austin, where I teach in the Butler School of Music and the Dell Medical School and in the Jackson School of Geosciences.
And we started by talking about the obligations institutions place on faculty to be both great teachers and prolific researchers without necessarily giving them many resources to do both.
First of all, I mean, teaching and research are different things. I mean, by definition, they're different things, right? But I think opinions vary tremendously among faculty about how committed they are to doing either or both of them, you know. And I think we paint with too broad a brush often and say, you know, researchers don't want to, or, you know, people don't value teaching. I just think it's, you can't have an intelligent conversation about something like that unless you start to think about, well, who are we talking about? In what context, in what kind of institution, you know? I mean, I think a thing that's been difficult in a lot of smaller institutions that have felt a need to become more researchy is they've created expectations for their teaching faculty to publish research without any of the resources, especially time, to do so. I mean, I teach at one of the major research universities in the United States, and so my course obligations are such that they allow me to devote time to research, and I can do that, and I enjoy that, and that's an important part of my life. As important, if not more important than teaching, but it's at least as important as teaching. But I have the time and space to do that. I think where institutions get in trouble is they, you know, pile teaching loads that are very high on faculty and then say, well, oh, and by the way, you need to be publishing in top journals in your field. And it's just not a realistic expectation, I think.
So it's kind of, you need to give the responsibilities either of being a top researcher or being a superstar professor.
Yeah,
it can't necessarily be the same.
Well, I mean, I think someone mentioned in one of the sessions this morning that, you know, there's little correlation between research prowess and teaching expertise. I mean, teaching is a skill. I think a lot of people who don't recognize that imagine, well, I'm not a good teacher, or I'm a satisfactory teacher, those kinds of things, as if it's some immutable aspect of being a human being, you know. When in fact, I mean, teaching is a skill that you can learn just like learning to play golf or baseball or anything else. It isn't uncomplicated. I mean, it's difficult to teach well. It's challenging to teach well. But if somebody's interested in doing so, even the person who thinks I'm a really terrible teacher can be. I think many times people mistake being entertaining and engaging with being a good teacher, you know. And I'm pretty entertaining and I'm pretty engaging, but that's not why I'm a good teacher. In fact, I think the more entertaining I am, the less well I'm teaching. You know, I just think a lot of people conflate the idea of engagement and activity on the part of students with and use that as evidence that they're learning, when in fact I'm engaged in a lot of things that I don't learn anything from, even though it has my full attention and I'm interested and I'm enjoying myself. But whether I learn anything from it is a totally different question. You know?
Do you think that's a common mistake among people who are teaching in higher education, that, and also maybe something that they're endeavoring to do, as students have people are saying that they've got lower attention spans, that they demand different things now?
Yeah, I don't buy any of that. I just don't. I mean certainly, you know, every generation of old people sees the younger generation as just being totally unlike, you know, what we were like when we were their age, and that's just mythology, you know. I mean, certainly the life experiences are different. we have access to all kinds of media and technology, you know, and travel and all kinds of things that make life a different thing. But the stuff that makes a human being, the stuff that leads to a satisfying life, that's not different. And I think, you know, when you cook it right, you can get students engaged and interested and actually committed to working hard at things that are genuinely meaningful for them. I mean, I think the frustration that many people feel is that when they're teaching something that's inherently uninteresting and they're teaching it in a way that emphasizes its lack of interest, and then they're sort of annoyed that students aren't fascinated by it. Well, what kind of ridiculous expectation is that? Yeah, exactly.
We've been talking a lot about different types of students, first-generation students, low-income students, mm-hmm. things like that. So has teaching changed in the past 10 years as the type of student that is now entering higher education has changed?
Well, I mean, when teaching has been responsive to who's in the classroom, it has. But I think often it's not. I mean, we know that there are predictors of success in higher education that have to do with income and family and past experiences and all those kinds of things. And certainly, first-generation students, for example, I was a first-generation student. I came to college with a totally different set of expectations, most of which were wrong, because no one in my family had ever been to college before. So, I mean, that was just something that I knew people did, and my parents wanted me to do it, but I didn't know what it was like, and they certainly couldn't tell me what it was like. So, I mean, there have to be extra supports that are available for people who haven't sort of been prepared through their primary and secondary education that this is your next step. You know, it's sort of interesting to me. I mean, many people who have grown up in a pretty privileged background, which I consider myself, you know, I grew up in a middle-class family and born in the 50s, and, you know, I had a pretty good life. Even though the education level of my family was relatively limited, there was no question of whether I was going to go to college. I mean, the question was where I was going to go to college, you know. And I think for many students who are first-generation students, and many of the students who come to Texas, you know, from the Rio Grande Valley and those kinds of things, where that's a conscious decision to attend college, and you're going to forego a job and income and instead pay tuition and do this thing. I mean, that's a huge choice for a family to make, you know. And I think, you know, it's certainly incumbent upon universities and faculty to acknowledge that, and that those students have a different level of resiliency, perhaps, because they're sort of responding to the vicissitudes of whatever is thrown at them when they get on a college campus. And I think the same is true for adult learners who, for whatever reason, of a life change, you know, their job was discontinued or they got a divorce or something, and now they're coming back to school. They have a different set of desires about what they want to get out of it and what they want to experience in it. So I think all of this really has to do with responding to what people want out of a college education. And I don't think we're good at sort of defining at the front end what should you expect to get out of a college education. I think more recently, you know, when I talk to parents and hear from, you know, students about what their parents' expectations are, much of it revolves around they're getting a good job with a good salary, and that's it. And certainly that's not an unimportant thing about getting a college education, but it was certainly nothing that I ever thought of and don't think of as a senior faculty member that's the reason to get a college education. You know, I mean, there are lots of cheaper ways to get trained for a high-paying job than getting a bachelor's degree in something, you know. And I think, unfortunately, all of the language that's been sort of it's crept into discussions about higher education, about students as consumers, and we're service providers. That's just a terrible way to think about an educational experience. Because if that were the case, I mean, we think about it, all business relationships with consumers and service providers are inherently adversarial. I mean, everybody's trying to give as little as possible as get as much as return as possible in return. That's a terrible model for learning.
I don't know if you've heard or know about the Teaching Excellence Framework that exists in the UK, which is where the government, basically, they give them awards based on the quality of their teaching, learning outcomes, graduate employment, all this stuff, and it gives them either gold, silver, or bronze. And part of their argument for doing this is so that students know what their money is going towards. They can get some sort of expectation before they choose a university, mm-hmm. what the outcome is going to sure. be for that. So mm-hmm. I guess going back to your argument saying it's not a student as consumer, it's not some sort of transaction, but you do have to make the argument in the United States, especially where tuition fees are so high, mm-hmm. it's good for students to know what they're putting their tens of thousands of dollars to.
I think it depends on some really important variables, and that is, what are the measures, and are they really measuring what's most important, and are the measures such that it's really possible to make valid comparisons among institutions that don't look very much alike? And I think everybody who has visited different kinds of institutions, I mean, small liberal arts colleges and large research universities and those kinds of things, realizes that they're in many ways incomparable. It's a different flavor on the campus. There's a different tenor in the place. And to say, well, this one's better than that one when you're comparing those. Now, I realize a lot of rankings and recognitions sort of sort out, these are liberal arts colleges, these are major research universities, those kinds of things. And I think it is important for people who are thinking about attending a university to know what that's like. And I don't know enough to speak intelligently about the teaching framework, but I think it is important to ask the question, are the measures that are being used truly indicative of what learners' experiences are like?
You talked about the need to look at learning, not necessarily teaching, but actually yeah. like learning. So if you could wave a magic wand, how would you fix the problem that you see in higher education and learning right now?
Well, If I knew that, even without a magic wand, I would make a lot of money. So I don't think there's a fix. But I will say something that I talked about during my talk, and that's this: almost all discussions about teaching spend little time talking about learning. And my take has always been, and when I first started working with undergraduates, I was working with a lot of students who were preparing to be teachers themselves, and my thought. And then, and still is, you know, telling somebody stuff to do as a teacher is, first of all, not very interesting. And second of all, it doesn't provide any rationale for why you're doing anything. And I think most people who are intelligent enough to gain entrance into a college or university are probably curious. I mean, they probably want to understand the way things work. And all that, whenever I do a faculty development thing for an institution, and I just talk about how people learn, including the people in the room who are attending, right? And then by implication, there are things to do about teaching because that's the way we learn. And generally, I think even when people sort of bemoan the fact that university faculty are very resistant to changing the way they teach those kind of things, I mean, certainly to an extent that's true, but I think they're much more amenable to thinking differently about the way they teach when the focus is on they're learning something about how their own brains work and the brains of their students. And now, I don't have to tell them, don't put up a PowerPoint slide with 100 words on it and make everybody copy it down while you read it. I mean, that then becomes something that seems stupid. But not because I told them, don't do that. It's because they actually, that's not going to do anything to help them understand that, right? So I think what my magic wand would do, even though it wouldn't solve all the problems, It would make understanding learning more a part of every teacher's repertoire.
Do you think there's a reason why we're talking about this now? Why we're having the inaugural Teaching Excellence Summit? Why the UK has launched a framework to try to improve or measure teaching in some way in higher education? Is there a reason why we're having this conversation now?
Well, I can't speak to what the incentives were or the impetus was in the UK. But I can say that in the United States, we're still grappling with the idea of what is actually measurable when it comes to teaching. I mean, can you even assess anything? And of course, it's not surprising to think that many people who are not particularly good teachers, you know, love to point to data that say that any measures of teaching are, you know, nonsense and you can't measure this and it's somehow ineffable and those kind of things. So I think the reason that this may be getting more attention now is that when people want to emphasize something and make it seem important, having a measure often not only calls attention to it, but makes people behave in ways that increase their scores on whatever the measure happens to be. And that's why I think picking the dependent variables is everything, right? Because there are all kinds of things you can get people to say, well, if you got a higher score if you did this, and they'll start doing that, but it doesn't make a damn bit of difference to what they're going to do as a teacher, right? But I think one of the things that happens in the research teaching, you know, competition or whoever you want to describe it, is that while those discussions are being had, if someone's being evaluated for promotion or tenure and they have a vita and they have a publication record and they have a grant record and it says, okay, how many grants have you won? Where have you published your research? How have you been cited? And they're clear indicators of whether somebody has done a good job as a scholar in their discipline. Teaching, you can look at students' course evaluations, you know, you can look at that and for whatever that's worth, and you could have peers go in and observe people teach and they can say whatever they observe in a classroom, but there's not the same kind of tangible measure that's been determined by other evaluators. I mean, the thing that's interesting about looking at a research record is that grants have been reviewed by grant review panels, right, that have no dog in that hunt. You know, they're just looking for the best grant and the most worthy thing. I mean, not quite, but it's close to that. And same thing with looking at publication records. You know, there are journal boards and editors, and they make decisions about that. So that all seems objective. And then we get to teaching, and there's nothing objective. You know, like, how do people feel about this? And students like my class and that kind of thing. And to say, well, are they actually learning anything? That was interesting, something that Richard Aram said today when he said, there are no good measures of learning. But then I see that as a bit of a contradiction when he says, well, he used the college learning assessment to say that no one's learning anything. Well, both those things can't be true, right?
Right.
So I think the complications of this revolve around the fact that not everybody comes in the door the same. You know, I mean, we teach using an industrial model, you know, because we want to teach large groups of people. And we want to sort of bring them through this experience all at the same time with the fictional belief that everyone's the same when they come in the door, and as long as they work hard, they'll all be the same when they leave. And that was just nonsense, you know. And I think so much of that revolves around how we choose to assess learning without recognizing that not everyone's going to learn precisely the same thing at the same time.
And that was Bob Duke from the University of Texas at Austin. That's it for today, but if you'd like to see more about the discussions from the Teaching Excellence Summit in Glasgow, you can find all of our coverage, including videos and news stories, on timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.